All right, everybody, welcome back. Episode 27 of the Strength Academy podcast. Grayson here, joined by Mundo.
What's up, y'all?
All right, guys. So I think we're going to have a pretty fun episode today. So the first thing that we kind of wanted to touch on was width in the squat and the kind of variety of stances and positions that you'll see people take, and kind of what we think is optimal and what we kind of want people to be working on when they're doing their squatting workouts.
Yeah, so when I'm trying to help people find what their squat position should be to start off with, I usually just like to have them find a comfortable place where they can squat full depth all the way down and then make adjustments from there. The thing that I like to see is the knees tracking over the toes, so the thighs are in line with the toes. And then I like to have that lower back posture nice and upright, and then like a little bit of arch to it. And I don't want to see collapsing at all. And so when I'm trying to find positions for those people, usually I have them start off shoulder width and then go from there. That's usually been a pretty good approach, but like sometimes people have to squat wider depending on how tall they are, what their limb lengths are. And the problem with a lot of Americans is that we're just varied so much in height and in limb length as well. And because you can have somebody that's shorter that has like really long limbs, and have like a really short torso. Cause I knew a guy, he was like 6'5" and he was all limbs. Like, yep. Sitting down, we were the same height, but like standing up, he was, you know, like a foot taller than me.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of hard sometimes to find the ideal positions for people. But I think that starting off in that shoulder width position and then seeing people get that full range of motion and then maintaining a back arch, trying to put those three things together are usually what helps get in the general area where they need to be.
Yeah. And this is an area that I've seen, people kind of have different approaches. You know, I think the shoulder width is a pretty good, like, standard starting point, but, you know, some people say just outside the hips, some people say just outside the shoulders. So there's kind of a lot of disagreement. And I think that, like, the first thing is you have to identify what is the purpose of the squat that you're doing. Because if you're squatting for squatting's sake, so say you're doing powerlifting or just trying to get, you know, your squat up for a field sport or something like that, that wider stance where you're going just below parallel, since in powerlifting you don't have to go as deep as you possibly can, that wider stance can kind of accommodate getting to just below parallel and back up and actually provide some kind of strength benefits, because you're just kind of maximizing a little more posterior chain involvement. You're kind of cutting the distance down to that parallel position. But, you know, for the Olympic squat, I think it's that, you know, shoulders to just outside hips, somewhere in that range, usually allows people to stay more upright as they descend. But what I'm kind of curious to know your opinion on is, you know, if you are getting somebody that's just starting out, like you said, the problems with a lot of Americans is that we have like a big, you know, diverse pool of what people's body types are, but also we tend to be working with populations that have spent a lot of time sitting. So the squat isn't like a second nature, natural position. So do you think it would be better to put somebody in that just outside the hips width or shoulder width squat, that kind of narrower stance, and, you know, say they have some sort of hip or ankle restriction? Do you think it's better to do partial range of motion in the stance that you preferably like to see, or let them go wider so that they can focus on squatting deeper even though the stance might not be optimal? Do you think there's like one way that you prefer over another? Because we've kind of played with both, and I've seen both work, but having to readjust the squat position as mobility improves can sometimes be a problem. So I'm kind of wondering if getting people into the position we want and having them work on depth through box squatting or partial reps and build themselves up using light weights to like work that mobility, or letting them squat but having them move it out a little bit so that they can hit depth, do you think that one is going to carry over better than the other?
I think that the one that is going to translate the most to the actual lift is probably the best one to use. And I know that sometimes people come in and they've already been squatting a certain way for a certain period of time. And then you factor in the fact that most adults spend a lot of time sitting. And when we sit, if you look at a normal chair height, it brings you to a parallel position. You're not sitting below parallel. So that range of motion ends up getting cut short. So I think it's important to try to develop the range of motion that's going to have the most carryover into the squat that you're trying to sit into. So in the case of where if you have an adult that needs to have a wider stance to sit down further, I think that it would probably be better to have that person have the stance that they need to be in to reach the full depth of the squat for the Olympic lift they're trying to be in without sacrificing having to make too much adjustments later.
Yeah, and I'm starting to really kind of be more aligned with that way of thinking. I think that if you're unable to do a barbell back squat or front squat in that ideal Olympic stance squat position, it might be better off if you're just starting out to really spend a few weeks. I mean, because if you're working on it pretty consistently, it'll come together and you'll be able to get it worked out, you know, working on your hip mobility, working on your ankle mobility. And for the hips, you know, it's not all about, you know, how mobile is it in external rotation, like how far can you get the knees out, but you need to make sure that you're mobile in internal rotation as well. That the knees just kind of hinging rather than having to twist outward or inward. I think that spending the first few weeks doing stuff like, goblet squats, where it's a little bit easier on that, you know, positioning, and you can kind of tweak things a little bit easier, you can start there and then build up towards squatting. But what's really hard, and where I kind of the reason I'm kind of thinking of this question, is if somebody comes in and they've been squatting in a wide stance where they send the hips back first instead of breaking the hips and knees together, so they're kind of doing that sit back powerlifting style squat, and they come in with a 300 plus pound squat, how do we make sure that that person stays motivated? Because if we just say, oh, we are going to goblet squat 35 pounds till you get your positions perfect, how can we make sure that we balance, like, that they feel like they're moving towards something? You know, it's how do you frame, like, no, we just need to work on this mobility and positioning, and, you know, the heavier weights will come back later. You know, like, do you think that, you know, you got to worry about, you know, people being bored or feeling like they're not going to be challenged with the workouts? Because I know that we've had, you know, instances where really strong people have come in and they weren't really moving the way that we wanted, so their whole workout was pretty light because it was just tweaking and fine tuning. And, you know, how do you think the balance should be struck between kind of like demanding that, you know, good posture, good stance, like perfect squat, versus like letting people kind of train and improve it as they go? Like, it's hard when you worry about that, you know?
Yeah, it is hard, because I've heard stories of other athletes that go to coaches and they make them dial back. And they want their technique to be perfect, but they never let them go up until it is. And then they feel like they've had a setback in their progress.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, as a coach, it's finding the line between keeping things challenging for them, but putting things in the direction that you want them to go and allowing them to continue to test themselves. So if somebody comes in and they have a really, you know, really good strength base, but the strength base isn't in positions that you want them to be in, then you kind of have to let them get, I'm not saying let them get away with shitty technique, but kind of let them work through some of the areas that need improvement without completely making them go back to the drawing board. So, like, let's say we got a new guy and he, you know, he squats like 300 pounds pretty easily. you know, he can bench like double body weight and, you know, deadlift triple body weight. But his front squat's garbage. Like, how do you keep that guy engaged? Well, you have to tailor the program to where you're strengthening the positions that are going to be carrying over into the Olympic lifts without sacrificing his ability to lift heavy as a total. So, and that's unfortunately, it's a hard balance to strike, and it's going to become very individualized at that point. But like, I think that if I went to if I had to find a new coach and I had to start over, like, and he was like, oh no, we're going to have to go all the way to the drawing board, you're just going to be working with the barbell for the next 6 weeks, I would probably not go back to that person.
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, this isn't specifically about squat stance, but just about technique in general. Alan asked me this last week when we met up for coffee, and I thought it was a really good question. It's, you know, how much leeway do you give within technique for your athletes? You know, so is it, you know, and I thought that was a good question, because there's a lot of different approaches that you can use. And I think it in large part kind of depends on the age of the person that you're working with.
Right.
You know, but I think, you know, if you demand utter perfection, it very rarely happens even at the highest levels. You know, I don't think that there's ever been a perfect lift. There are examples of technical errors everywhere within weightlifting at the highest level, because yeah, it's individual. You know, there's the ideal technique, but I don't think anybody actually possesses an ideal technique. Everybody's making a mistake somewhere. And, you know, I think, so you got to find that balance between letting them push in some direction while you're really making them like emphasize working on the things that you want. But if you're never letting them try to use that technique with a heavier load that challenges their positions, then I feel like you're, because if you, it doesn't matter how perfect you get at executing a snatch with 30 kilos, you can be really great at a 30 kilo snatch, but if you're still too weak to lift 45, you're not going to lift 45.
Right.
So I think we have to find that balance between getting technique, moving in the right direction, putting the emphasis on movement quality, but letting them work with weights that challenge those positions, because I think that's where you can really start to, you know, solidify what you're working on. Because you could, because most people can usually do pretty well with their lighter weights, but if you're never letting them work with weights that maybe they went a little too early, but stay with that weight and kind of be like, okay, no, now just keep your arms a little bit longer, maybe do some repeat singles, where you can really kind of, maybe the first couple are a little bit off, but the later ones come on and are a little bit better.
Right.
It goes the other way too, where if somebody's not quite in shape to do full snatches and full cleans yet, you have to do all of the preparatory work, overhead split squats, snatch grip presses, deadlift position work. So you have to find, you know, ways to keep them entertained through doing the monotonous thing. So one thing I think is really important is if you're working with somebody and maybe they can't quite get into a good overhead squat position yet, you need to be doing a lot of drills and stuff for that overhead squat, but you can't neglect the need for that person to feel like they're making progress. Right. So you have to find an exercise that they can push. So maybe their squats are a little bit off, but their deadlifts are really good. So maybe we can let them push the deadlift a little bit heavy so they feel like they're making that progress and they're kind of getting the feeling of, you know, moving some heavy weights, but they're starting off with all of that little detail position work and then pushing it on the exercise that they can actually manage.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to approach it. We had an athlete that was part of our club for a little bit that he wanted to pretty much just max out all the time, but his positions were not great, and he didn't really want to listen, and kind of like we wanted to take him back to not the drawing board on some of his lifts, but there was quite a bit of adjustments that needed to be made, and mobility wise he wasn't getting into the positions he needed to maintain consistency at higher level weights, and and as much as you try to explain to some people that this is going to benefit them in the long run, sometimes taking that step back has to be done for you to make improvements. But some people just refuse to accept that. And in that case, it's not really on us to make that decision for them. It's up to them to say, this is where I want to be, and to get there, I'm going to have to take this step back. But you have to trust that you're going to get to where you need to be in the end or after this period. So if you're working with a coach and all of a sudden, you know, they're starting to want to change things for you, it might set you back in some weights. Don't give up on the fact that that's happening, or don't give up on their plan because you're having to take a step back, because it might benefit you in the long run. So be open-minded to the fact that maybe you haven't been doing things right, and that something needs to be corrected, and for you to progress from that, you have to make some of those corrections, and it's gonna cost you a couple kilos, or it's gonna cost you, you know, some of those higher end percentages. And you know, as athletes, you can't, if it's constantly just about you and about your ego, like you're never just gonna get as far as you could if you listen and trust that other people have the best interest for you. Like when somebody comes and they're strong but they don't have the greatest technique, my immediate thought isn't, oh, I want to hold them back because they're stronger than me or my athletes or whatever. It's never that. It's where are they at technically, and where can they be if they only took a few weeks to start working on these things? How much more could they improve? And so if you can trust that a coach has that envision for you, then I think you're going to have a lot more success in getting, you know, better at weightlifting or better at any kind of fitness thing in general. And that can apply toward anything. Like if you think you know it all and that you're the strongest you can be at where you're at, then why even have a coach?
That's a pretty good point. Yeah, I think, you know, if you are a coach kind of working with, you know, and you get somebody in that's very strong, sometimes a really good approach can be, you know, if you can identify an area that a strong person has a weak link and point that out to them the first day, that can get them hooked and get them listening to you, right? So like say, you know, you get a strong person in and you put them on a hip extension and you say, okay, do 20 reps, and their back is screaming by the end of it with just body weight. You can say, okay, so here, this is our weak link. This is one of the things that we're going to need to work on. So you can kind of, if you can point out like the ways that they'll be much better if they address these things and point it out to them through exercises like that, you can, you know, kind of be like, well, see, you have a really hard time pressing in that snatch grip. So you're super strong, but the muscles that need to hold that are weak. So you can highlight that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then for people that have been strength training for a long time, that's going to piss them off, and they're going to want to get much better at it.
Yeah, hopefully.
But yeah, I think that, you know, sometimes you do need to take a step back. Like if you're one of the people that, you know, has a hard time with their hips rocking back in the squat, or you feel like you need to be out pretty wide, being willing to take, you know, 12 weeks to maybe just work a little bit lighter where you're not having that breakdown rep to rep, you know, where you're not really shifting too far back or you're not leaning over as much. In the long run, you're going to be able to drive those numbers up. And I think with squatting and the squat stance, it's very important to remember the point of what you're doing. You know, weightlifting isn't a sport about how much weight can you squat. It's a sport about how much you can snatch and clean and jerk.
Right.
So your squat, you want to make sure that everything you do carries over as much as possible. You know, it's the same reason, you know, you hold clean positions when you deadlift versus, you know, doing kind of a higher hip conventional deadlift. It's the reason that we stay over the bar longer when we do our pulls. You know, it's not that we want to do pulls with the most weight possible, because that technique might look a lot different. It's not that we want to squat the most weight possible. It's that we need to be in the correct positions. And, you know, I think this goes back to, like, it's really important to remember that the squat's just an accessory lift. It's like curls and tricep extensions. You know, it's getting your individual muscle groups stronger to handle the weights for snatch or clean and jerk. And it's not an end in itself. Like, the squat isn't going to solve all your problems.
Right.
Because if you're squatting poorly and your squat goes up 20 kilos, your lifts will probably stay the same because you're just not going to get the carryover. Versus if you worked on getting a perfect squat 10 kilos under your best in a bad squat, that's probably going to make your clean and jerk go up a little bit better. I think a good example of the constant need of adjustment, we can use Alan as an example for this. So, you know, when he came in, his mobility was very poor. So he could maybe sit to about just above parallel. And we've constantly worked on mobility and all of that, but we've also let him squat within the ranges of motion that was allowed to him. So we didn't compensate his stance very much. We just sacrificed, like, okay, well, you're going to squat to here, and then we're going to try to work on getting that deeper and deeper and deeper as we go.
Right.
And it's been kind of a gradual process. So, you know, it's not always, you know, a big leaping PR, because when we approach that weight again, 4 or 5 months later, he's sitting a half an inch lower. So maybe it's the same weight, but if you squatted it deeper and more upright, then it's still an improvement, you know? So it's not always weight on the bar. It's like, what positions are you in when you have those weights on the bar? And just like using that kind of gradual step. But I think that had we not let him squat until he could hit perfect full depth, he probably would have gotten bored within a couple of months.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, like struggling and working with those weights. So I think it's, you know, it's tough because maybe in an ideal world where, you know, our athletes have to be there and have to do what we say, we might have a different approach. You know, it might be, no, we're really going to get everything absolutely perfect. You're not going to lift anything until we have the mobility down.
Yeah.
And then you're not going to move any weights up until we have this. And, you know, we're always going to be working on, you know, that perfect range of motion. But even then, I think that, like, countries that do have that setup, like the Chinese, they'll still make their lifters push weights to the point that form breaks down.
Right.
Like, they talk about, you know, you want to do snatch deadlifts till the back rounds, you know, because if you're not pushing that limit strength, then you're not really, like... So I'm not saying you need to round your back when you deadlift,
yeah.
But I'm saying that if you're doing a max and your back rounds a little bit, that's not like, oh, we are never doing that weight again.
Right.
You know, it's okay. Next time we do that, we're going to hold that position better.
And I agree with that, because if you don't push people to a certain threshold, you won't know where things break down and you won't know where you can strengthen something. Or where something can be improved. And it's basically this kind of like bubble of pushing things just a little bit past every time, bringing it back, pushing it past. So like this wave of strength and technique building. And that's kind of how I look at the process of building a weightlifter. It's like an ocean wave. You know, you build up, there's a crest, you find out where things start to become shaky, wobbly, where you start missing, where things break down technically, back off, build up, back off, build up. And it's just like this process of just forming that base and building and then continuing to tweak all those things until you can get them to the closest to being at their full potential that they can be. And so like you'll never know how close they are if you don't allow them to push. So if you only want things to be perfect all the time, you know, it's kind of like, well, you don't know how fast your car goes unless you push, you know, full throttle on an open highway.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not advocating, oh, we'll just let things fall apart completely off the rails. Like, you'll know, like, this is the edge of where they're at right now.
Within reason.
Yeah. You know, and that comes with experience as well as a coach, because, like, if you see an athlete and they're struggling and they're hitting a weight that, you know, is a couple kilos under their max or a couple kilos above and they're going for PRs, and you'll know that things are falling apart and where they're falling apart. There's no reason to keep pushing them and making them do that weight over and over or allowing them to do it. You'll see within the first couple tries, like, oh, this is definitely not happening because of this. Or this is an area that needs to be improved before they can get this position consistently. So the point is to push them towards an area of consistency and strength, and not just letting them max out and, you know, oh, well, they'll get stronger just by attrition of doing that many reps. So,
yeah, and I think it's that middle ground between being an ultimate perfectionist and not caring how somebody's lifting.
Right.
You know, like, for example, if somebody's, you know, going heavy and they catch a snatch, but they walk forward two steps, is that an egregious enough error that you say, you're done for the day, you can't do any more snatches, you have to go down and wait, or is it hit that again and see if you can clean it up?
Yeah, so, like, you know? In that case, I think it's, you know, it's what I refer to as maybe like a technical max and then an absolute true max, right? So a technical max is something where they're hitting the positions they need to hit. They don't take those steps forward. There's not a lot of, like, wobbling or anything going wrong. So, like, a technical max is how proficient they are at hitting that lift at that weight in those conditions. And then an absolute max is, like, you get maybe three attempts at this specific weight. You hit it, you can go up. And that keeps happening until they don't make with weights anymore. So, like, there's those two different approaches. So, like, if I want somebody to hit a technical max, I'd call it, like, a heavy single for the day, right? If it's a true max, like, give it a weight three attempts. If you don't make it within those three attempts, then that's it. If it's you miss the first two times, make it the third, then try, add a little more weight and go again and do the same thing.
So is that how you kind of differentiate notation of heavy single from test max?
For me, yeah.
Okay.
So, like, a heavy single, because, like, it could be just for that day, because you won't... A heavy single doesn't mean that you'll necessarily hit a PR. Or that you're going to be hitting, like, a lifetime best weight every single time. It's what you can accomplish for that day. It's basically the equivalent of saying, I want you to push your limit for today and see what you can get. And if it technically starts falling apart, then that's it for the day.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. Because heavy single is just to build, you know, confidence in the upper percentages of weights. But if your heavy single is 92% for the day, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think you just need to let people push, especially when they're, you know, coming to you voluntarily and, you know, expect to be getting some sort of a workout in. So if they are requiring a lot of remedial stuff, letting them push in the areas that they can, especially when you're starting later, because I think, you know, starting at 25, there's a little bit more urgency to get the strength up because you don't have as long as if somebody's starting when they're 13.
Right.
You know, so if you're starting when you're 13, we're, you know, with, well, especially with children, we're always way more like, no, you know, dial it back.
Yeah.
Because they have longer, right? We were able to build that foundation before layering in the strength when they get older. But when you're dealing with adult populations, you have to kind of try to do both at the same time. You have to try to refine the technique, but let them continue to get stronger because they need to if they're going to be if they want to keep lifting, especially right. Competitively.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I think going all the way back around to the stance issue, you know, take a look at where you're squatting, and if it's wide enough that you have a really hard, like, if you have a hard time keeping your knees out, it might be that your stance is too wide. It might not be that you need to do more glute activation. It might be that your feet are just too wide to be aligned for your particular hip, you know, situation. And I think that there is something to be said for continuing to develop the ability to do squats in a narrow stance, because, you know, or even, you know, like, significantly narrow, like a pulling stance or, like, feet 4 inches apart. Because I think that if you can squat in those positions, you're really addressing some mobility stuff. But that goes to say that too, that I think you should be able to squat in a significantly wider stance than you usually do, because doing those sort of things can help just hit different muscle groups. So, yeah. You know, if you need to work on, you know, strengthening your adductors, doing that kind of wider stance squat could be really beneficial because you're going to have to be engaging them to keep everything aligned. But your day-to-day front squat, back squat that isn't a different style, I think you should be working towards, you know, like we said, where can you sit the lowest and, you know, not sacrifice torso angle for depth. And a lot of it, I think, is like probably like 70% ankle mobility.
Yeah.
Like a lot of so much is ankle mobility, because most of the time, if you put someone in that narrow stance and they're struggling, if you put their heels up on a plate, they're going to go down no problem. And, you know, I think that's the biggest thing, because our, I don't know what it is about the way that we live our lives, but our ankles just do not move the way that they're supposed to. I don't know if that's that, you know, most people playing sports when they grow up, it's a lot of running, tightening up the calves. I know for sure that, you know, my time in the Army tightened my ankles up a lot, because it's just walking around with weight on your back and boots all the time. You know, that kind of restricts that ankle. So, you know, make sure that, you know, if you're trying to optimize your squat, you should be trying to optimize your flexibility. Because that's going to be the most important thing going on, and keep you from getting hurt.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, injury prevention is a big one for sure.
But yeah, I think, you got anything else to add on the squatting front, technical wise?
No, I think we covered everything, and then, even a little bit outside of what we intended to talk about.
But, I think that those things are important to keep in mind, especially if you're, you know, coaching a team or just helping your friends out, you know, cause I know that a lot of us like that, that's how we get, you get your start, is that you're working out a lot and then other people ask you to help them with a workout plan. And so if you are kind of, you know, helping your friends out, thinking about those sort of things, like, okay, well, let's make sure that, you know, you can push something, but you're demanding, you know, that improvement in mobility and position alongside it.
Right.
But that kind of brings us to part two today, which I kind of wanted to talk about, like, the different... So, we just said a bunch of things. We just gave a bunch of advice about where we think the hips should be, what, you know, order we should be focusing on things, whether it's, you know, technique first, or like all technique or all strength or somewhere in the middle. But how do we really know those things? So what I kind of want to dive into is, do you really know something if you just read it? So like if you read a book or like a article on Wikipedia or get in your encyclopedia and memorize the paragraph and regurgitate it, does that mean that you know that information? You know, like, do you have to do something with the information in order for it to be true knowledge? Or is it, you know, because like sometimes like I'll read an article about, you know, politics or anything like that, and you can read somebody else's opinion, but does that mean that you really know that information? And, you know, what is it, like, what threshold is there to say, I know this?
I think that it depends on the information. And if there's some kind of way to apply it, so for example, if you go to YouTube and you watch a video on how to snatch, that doesn't mean that you know how to snatch.
Yes.
After watching the video. Or if you read an article describing a snatch, that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to snatch. So in that case, I think that having the knowledge isn't the same thing as being able to apply the knowledge. There's no practicality to it. So to really know something, in my estimation, is to be able to explain it and do it. So, and as a coach, like, I don't know how to squat 200 kilos, right? I know how to squat. I know what a 200 kilo squat would look like, but I personally don't know how to squat 200 kilos. Like, I don't know what changes at that point.
Like, yeah.
Do I have to hold my breath tighter? Do I have to force my my lats down harder to maintain a more upright position? Do I need to push more flatly through the feet? I can't describe exactly what it would take because I've never been there myself. But can I describe to an athlete what they should be doing and have them feel out those things and give them the tools that they need to accomplish it? Yes.
So that's kind of an example where, you know, it's knowing the theoretical, right? So like knowing what it should look like, what you should be focusing on is very different than being able to do it yourself. And what I kind of wonder is like, you know, quality of knowledge or quality of retention. So if you are programming for a group and you assign a lot of hypertrophy work and you see a muscle growth response, so you give high reps, people put on muscle, versus you just read a study that said that higher reps produce muscle increases. You've arrived at the same conclusion through two different means. One, a purely theoretical rationality where you're thinking through the physiological processes, you're understanding the science, and you know that that's the result that they found in the study, versus the other, which is a more sensory thing. You were there, you observed, you adjusted, and then came to the same conclusion. But those processes getting there are different. And what I kind of wonder is, like, is the quality of knowledge different through something you gain through physical experience, whether it's observational or hands-on, versus, you know, just reading about something? Because my problem is that I always, like, you know, if you know, just because you read, you know, Greg Everett's Olympic lifting, you might understand all the theoretical bits of how to adjust something or, you know, like what you were looking for in the technique. But if you're never doing the physical, never applying it, I don't know if you can say that you really know something, you know. And this is the problem of, you know, YouTube comments or Instagram comments, right, where you'll get somebody being like, ah, you probably shouldn't step forward or that's going to hurt your shoulders. But, you know, it's like, well, they think that they know that because of the things that they've read.
Right.
And I think that, you know, it's, you know, like we talked about, it's like going, you know, like a seminar, right? Like if you go to a seminar for a day, do you really come out of that with real knowledge, or do you come out of that with an outline of what you need to work on going forward? You know, like, is that the end?
No, I think there's always layers of information to try to peel apart and learn from. And I think for me, the best way to learn is through application, right? So I can read something and have an idea, but the practical application, the actual doing something with it, provides a more solid base for me to recount my experiences from and then translate them for other people. So I think that the quality, as far as like, if you just read a book and then whether you just experimented and then came to the same conclusion, the quality is the same as long as you're able to reproduce the results that you want to reproduce.
Okay, reproduction. That's an interesting way to do it. Yeah.
So, but the thing is like, whether you know it, knowing something just means that you understand it well enough. And whether it's through your own lens of perception is one thing, because you can't really ever be sure about anything.
Yeah.
Not really. And if you say that you are, like if you know that this is absolutely the only way to do things, I'm not going to buy into it because I don't think that, I'm too skeptical to think that way. Like that there's an absolute way to do everything. I think that there's so many ways to accomplish something that there can never really be a true, specific, right way to do it.
Well, and that's just it, you know. So what you end up with if you keep going down this rabbit hole is realizing that true, objective, 100% knowledge about anything, but we'll keep it with weightlifting. So like true, objective, the best program is this.
Right.
I don't think it really exists, because really, you know, you're piecing together bits of sensory data from doing or bits of rational stuff from reading and thinking about it. But what you really end up with isn't knowledge, but a belief.
Right.
So, like, I believe it's important to do high rep work because of this data that I've done, but a belief isn't the same as knowing something.
Right.
Right? So, sure. Like, if you believe that higher rep work is good for tendon health, right, or you believe that you should do tens in the squat sometimes to build a base to do heavier weights, you can back those beliefs up with bits of science or bits of practical application, or I just thought about this and kind of came to this conclusion. But what you end up with isn't necessarily knowledge of that subject, like in the, like, you know, cosmic order, like I understand the universe sense.
Right.
It's I have a belief that's influenced by these. But beliefs can change. Knowledge can't, right? Because if it's true, it's true 100% all the time.
Right.
So I think that's...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, like what we're talking about is, you know, like I believe that this works, but whether that's, you know, capital K knowledge, like 100% right. truth, there's just too much gray area.
Well, I'll take it a step further and I'll throw the belief word out of the window and just put an idea. Like my idea about this thing is that this is how it works. Because ideas, you're more susceptible to change an idea and be open-minded to new ones than you are to change a belief.
Exactly.
Because if you believe something, that means that you've already put stock in it. And more often than not, when you're looking up information or you're looking up ways to do things or you're looking up more knowledge, then you're going to be biased towards things that already reinforce what you believe. But if you have ideas like, well, this is what my idea is about this thing, you'll be more receptive to saying, well, this idea over here contradicts the one that I already have. What's different about them? What can I glean from this that would change or make my idea more closer to knowledge than it would to a belief? Because like beliefs, people die for beliefs.
Yeah.
They'll fight over on the internet over what they believe in. You know, they believe that CrossFit is bad, or they believe that, you know, deadlifts will hurt your back or squatting is bad for your knees. People believe those kinds of things. But in reality, those are just bad ideas.
Yeah.
Ideas that have been perpetuated by different parts of the fitness industry. And so people hold on to these beliefs and they're not willing to change them. But if they were just ideas and the ideas are closer to knowledge, because knowledge says that squatting isn't bad for your knees. Maybe squatting in a particular way is. Or with particular form might be, but squatting in general, everybody does it. People across ages and across cultures squat. You know, they bend down, they pick things up. It's a deadlift. Picking up your groceries off the floor is a deadlift.
Yeah.
You know, so these are simple movements, but just because it's more weight and it's done with a specific type of object doesn't make it bad. So I think it's better to hold on to the idea of gaining knowledge or acquiring knowledge and then being adaptable to when things contradict those ideas so that you can be open to acquiring, you know, a different perspective than what you already have than it is to hold on to a belief. Because if you think you know something, and that's a problem. Because how, like we were just talking about, like how can you really know? Like how close is that concept that you have in your mind to actual knowledge, capital K,
yeah,
knowledge, like being the truth.
Yeah, and I think that problem presents itself in, you know, not just lifting, but just everything. You know, there's, you know, people that say, okay, well, this is the way to do it. Like, I only use the Bulgarian system because that's the only thing that works. But they're, you know, feeding that confirmation bias by kind of only reading or reinforcing those things, but not looking at, you know, all the successful training that has nothing to do with that. So yeah, I like the idea that ideas are mushy and can be molded and adjusted. But then as a coach, do you feel a conflict with that? Where if you, you know, really feel that, you know, there's just ideas about how to do things and you can play with ideas and you can adjust them and tweak them. You know, I feel like, you know, sometimes people look for people with certainty, right? Like, people are always attracted to the person that says, I know how to do it, and this is the way that it's going to work.
Yeah.
Whether that's, you know...
That's how culture started.
Exactly. You know, like, but, like, you know, whether that's, you know, spiritualism or politics or any of these sort of things, people buy in when people say, I know the truth, and it's this. And how do you market, I'm learning too? You know, like, I'm changing my ideas. I'm doing different things. You know, I'm always kind of evolving the way that I think about training and always trying to find a better way or tweak something here and there. And, you know, that might not sound as good as I have a solid, foolproof system that will work for everybody. You know, so it's that, you know, like, because I have a hard time, you know, saying, like, saying anything past, as I understand it right now, this is true.
Right.
Or this is backed up by observation or a study or, like, anecdote. So there's, you know, like, as I see it right now, this is how it works. But that's not the same as saying I 100% know the answers to things. And it's, I worry that, you know, people misunderstand that as, I don't know what I'm doing. It's no, I know what I'm doing within the framework of the things that I know right now.
See, but you're being a reasonable, rational person. And the thing is like, from history, if you look at any past, like, cult type of scenario, there's always one guy at the head of the boat saying, I know the way, this is it, follow me. And that guy could be leading everybody off a cliff, right?
But oftentimes is.
Yeah, and it oftentimes is, exactly. And the thing is, like, if you have somebody, and let's bring that towards the weightlifting community. Let's say you have, you know, one coach preaching that this is the method. His method is the way that you build strong lifters, that you build national champions, that you build Olympic athletes. And then, you know, he gets this huge following, and then everybody's getting hurt on his program, and then they fall off. But he is getting people to stick with it, because what's happening is he's filtering out the people that aren't able to handle his program, and then the people that are able to genetically stay with it and are proving him right. So in his idea, he's reinforcing what he believes, and people are seeing what he believes is true because he is getting results. But what about all those other people that got flushed out and injured and got left behind?
Yeah.
You know, so in one aspect, what he could be saying is true from his perspective, but from the perspective of somebody that's on the outside saying, well, his method really isn't the best. It just worked for those people. And so I think in our case, like, we've talked about this, because Grayson and I aren't the type of people that's saying, like, we have the best things, we have the best methods, we have the best ways of coaching, but we're confident in our ability to get people stronger and better over time. But that's not sexy. It's not sexy to say, oh, I can get you to this level if you put the time in and stick with me, and we'll learn together. I don't know it all, but what I do know, I know I can get you there, and we can refine that as things go along. But that's not as sexy as saying, I know the way, I can get you there, guaranteed. Because that's, it's too much of a reasonable approach. And we're not so ego-driven that we're going to say, you know, our gym is the best gym, or our weightlifting coaches are the best coaches, or our method is the best method. The way we approach it is, we want you to be the best athlete that you can be at the level that you want to be at. And if we don't have the knowledge specifically to get you there, we can acquire it, whether it's together or by our continued, you know, self, you know, progression and self-study. But that's not as sexy as the former, as preaching that we know the way.
This is the system, everybody will do it. Because, you know, everybody that, you know, we do, like if you look at, you know, like, kind of like our nationals team, right? Everybody does fairly different things, because some people respond really well to one thing over the other. And if I said, everybody has to do block work from above the knee because that works for everyone, well, some people don't need work in that position, so it's right, not really going to be the best use of their time. And yeah, I just feel like there's so much gray area within what you can know within weightlifting, because, you know, we're always learning, we're always reading, and there's always a new idea that you want to play with, because you don't want to, you know, be like, well, that disagrees with my current system, so I'm going to ignore it.
Right. Yeah.
Because you might be missing out on something valuable. It might be stupid and you can try it out and then be like, well, that was dumb, I'm not doing that anymore. But if you don't, you know, like play with these different ideas, you know, you don't continue to grow and make progress.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want your ideas to ossify and kind of turn into this hardened thing that can't be tweaked or changed or isn't open to new possibilities.
Yeah. And I would even go as far as to say, as sometimes bad ideas can have good outcomes.
Oh yeah. you can learn something from anybody. You know, if somebody's saying, you know, crazy off the wall stuff, if they say 1,000 things, you might get 3 good things out of that though. You know, like there's going to be, you know, some sort of value that you can glean from just any sort of information processing. And I think, for me, what makes it hard is that, you know, you want to, you know, kind of, you know, get people to buy into what you're doing. But with this process, you just need them to understand, like, this is a refinement. We're finding what works for you. And once we find it, we're going to keep doing that and we're going to keep working on it. But I think that, you know, like the problem for me is that that skepticism doesn't, you know, originate for me as just in the weightlifting realm. It's kind of my disposition in general.
Yeah.
Is, you know, like, well, what can you really know? You know, it's that, you know, like, are you a brain in a vat? Can you really be sure? Can you really trust your sensory experiences? You know, like, can you really trust that anything is really there? Because, right, you know, you can't prove that you're not dreaming right now.
Yeah. How do you know you're not laying in a hospital bed in a coma and this is all a dream?
Yeah. And there isn't really a very satisfying answer to that. So I think, you know, whether or not you can never truly know anything, you certainly can't know anything about weightlifting, because you can't even be sure if you really have hands. You know, you could be hooked up to a computer and be a brain and a jug, and it's giving you the same, you know, electrical currents that project an image of you having a hand sitting at your desk. But you can't be certain of even the most fundamental things in your daily life. And it's not productive to say, well, I can't be sure that this is it, so I'm not going to do anything. So that's, you know, so that would be, you know, saying, well, you can't teach weightlifting. It's, no, is you can, you know, be certain enough to get things done, but you have to be open to the idea that, you know, there might be something profoundly strange, yeah, at the base level of everything, and that, you know, what you could really know is just the contents of your thoughts. You, right, know, that's really all you can know for sure. Because if you're, you know, reading a book, maybe you're just being, you know, you're in the Matrix, you're you're reading a simulated book.
Well, the way I look at it is, nobody knows what the hell they're doing, and we're all winging it. And the reason that I have a coach is because I trust that that person is winging it less than I am at this point. So, or, you know, they have an area of expertise that I don't have any really knowledge in. So their level of winging it is much less than mine is. So I'm going to, you know, use their experience and their areas of knowledge and expertise to further enhance mine. And so if you approach life that way, it's just like, if you take a look at everybody at any level, whatever they're doing, they're winging it on some level. They don't know what the hell they're doing. Like, there's no rule book for any of this. There's no set of instructions. I know that people are like, the Bible is the basic instructions before leaving Earth, but I'm not going to argue with you about that. I'm just saying, like, in general, there's no specific way to do anything, and everybody's winging it. And any advice that anybody gives you has to be taken with a grain of salt, because they're in the same boat that you're in. Like, they're in the same reality, same existence that you're in. And hopefully, with their knowledge and experience through what they've gone through in their lifetime, they have a little more knowledge so that they don't have to wing it as much as you would have to. So you have to learn it all on your own. And that's all coaching is. Coaching is just saying that I've learned as much as I can about this up to this point, and I'm not having to wing it as much as I used to. and I'm going to help you not have to wing it as much as you need to right now. Or I'm going to bring your level close to mine, like through my experience. So I think that if you just take a look at it, at things being that way, even if you go on Instagram and all these people that are giving advice and all these things about how to improve this or improve that or improve your diet, if you just think about it as like they're just winging it a little bit less than you, then you'll be less inclined to be angry about when something doesn't work out or you don't get the results that you want, because in reality, nothing's guaranteed.
Yeah, and there's just so much individual variation with things,
right?
That, you know, a good example was we once, for the team program, we did the Russian squat cycle, right?
So
it was a really kind of valuable lesson, because it was, you know, some people hit 20 kilo PRs and some people couldn't finish it. And that was just such a valuable, like, no one thing is going to work for everybody. So you have to really kind of be refining and adjusting things that, you know, there are general things that you need to work on, but the ways that you can approach it, whether it's, you know, high repetitions, low repetitions, like there's always going to be a lot of variation in that. And I think that it's dangerous as a coach to, if you get to a point where you're certain about what you're doing, if you're not, you know, reflecting and criticizing your own performance as a coach, like, was that program the best program I could have written? And not going back in and saying, okay, well, things kind of fell off the rails around week 7. Let's take a look at weeks 5 through 5 and 6 and see if we can figure out what caused that problem in week 7.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not willing to criticize the things that you believe or be like, okay, well, maybe this thing isn't the right option, your people aren't going to make optimal progress, or they're not going to make it as far. And, so I think you just have to be skeptical about your own beliefs in order to keep learning. Because if you think that you know it, you're going to stop looking. And if you stop looking, you're going to miss something.
Yeah. And I think coaches are like parents too. Not everybody should be a parent. So sometimes you just have to like say, this is not a, you know, the person for me. It's just like, you know, because a lot of time athletes are like children. You know, you watch them grow, you try to help them get to where they need to be, and then, you know, the most rewarding thing is watching them be able to work on their own and only needing a little bit of feedback. And that's kind of how parenting is like, you in the beginning you give them a lot of feedback, you're constantly doing corrections, constantly correcting their course, you know, trying to build them up, building them, you know, mentally, physically, all that. And then eventually they grow up and they go off on their own, right? That's the whole point, is to send them off on their own so that they can accomplish things on their own. And as a coach, you're trying to build people up mentally, physically, you know, trying to get them to the point where they're you know, autonomous. They don't need you as much.
You're
still
there.
You're
providing guidance rather than direct critique every step of the way.
Yeah, but some parents are trash, and they shouldn't have had kids, or, you know, they messed their kids up. And, you know, some coaches are like that too. It's just like, you can't trust that everybody that has a certificate is a good coach. So you have to be able to recognize the times when it's like, oh no, this person's not going to work out for me. And so, and if it's those people that are like, I'm the only coach that can get you there, I'm the only one that knows how to do this, is like, well, that's a red flag, like, for me. So like, coaches are like parents. Not everybody has great parents, but unfortunately, you can find a new coach. You can't always find new parents.
Exactly. You know, I think, you know, that role of, you know, questioning and skepticism can be important in an athlete as well, because we learn from the questions our athletes ask. So, like, this week, one of our remote athletes asked me a question regarding the program, because she was like, well, the squats didn't move up from last week. They moved up in these other 2 days, but this one stayed the same. Is there a reason for that? So then I explained why I had kept those back a little bit. And in doing so, like, I like getting those kind of questions, mm-hmm. because if I get a question and I don't have an answer, I know that I didn't make that wasn't a well thought out decision. Like, if you don't have a reason for doing something, right. So I think it's important for athletes to understand your intention. So asking questions is very good, but then having your athletes at like be open enough and, you know, have like two-way communication with your athletes where they're comfortable asking, why am I doing this? And you have an answer to that. That's an indication that you're in a pretty good coaching relationship. Like, yeah, you should be able to ask questions and say, okay, well, what's the purpose behind this? What's the intent? Because I feel like if you know the intent of your squat workout, you can execute it better. So I think, you know, just being able to keep an open mind and ask questions and not, you know, feel attacked if somebody does kind of say, well, why am I doing this? And not to be like, oh, you don't trust me? Get off the program.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you should look at that as an opportunity for you to check your own knowledge and make sure that you know why you're doing something or know why something is the way that it is.
Absolutely.
And if you get asked a question that you don't know the answer to, that's a gap in your, you know, knowledge and an area that you need to expand your ideas.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think, yeah. Got anything else to add?
No, I think that concludes the conversation for today.
Yeah, we don't know, but we have a good idea.
Yeah. We don't know exactly where you need to squat, where your stance should be, but we have a pretty good idea. All right. Until next time, y'all, happy lifting.
Take it easy.